Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's great to be here. I met Jerry a lot later than these people. Jerry put out his book, which you gotta read. And I said, I'm a writer. I said, I don't need to meet Jerry. I immediately heard from Jerry, we gotta go to lunch. And you went to Il Piccolino on Robertson, where they had the Jerry Weintraub special. Now, the fascinating thing about Jerry, and a lot of time this is at the elite players, is they're icons. And you think, you always are trying to go up the ladder. But he was so endearing, so human. The other thing is, as soon as you know him, he started sharing details about his personal life, about his kids and this and that. Maybe it was only me, but he always did that. And we maintained a relationship. And the other thing I realized is he was the progenitor. People who were a little bit younger grew up with David Geffen being ruling and then Irving Azoff. I realized Jerry did it first. If you know Irving loves to connect you with doctors and do all that stuff. That's what Jerry did first. He says, the first I wake up and I hook everybody up with the doctors and I do that. That was a real manager. I went through the exhibit. It was kind of weird because Jerry was so alive, and to see the pictures was really kind of creepy. And if you lived through that era, you know what a tumultuous time it was. We were inventing it. That's one thing about the music business today. We're not inventing much. Certainly, we were in turmoil for about 20 years with Napster at all. But Jerry changed so many things and invented so many things. And certainly, that was when music drove the culture. I mean, I'm looking at things. Oh, I was at that Led Zeppelin thing. Oh, I couldn't get tickets to Wings Over America. You just remember everything immediately. So I'm going to jump right in. We'll introduce people as we go along. Now, Claire, how did you first hear of Jerry?
Well, it was all the way back in the days when I was at the Spectrum.
Okay, the Spectrum in Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia.
Now, the one thing about the Spectrum is legendary that the roof blew off.
Oh, yes. And I had a dog and pony show all about how we were going to put it back together again by the Franklin Institute.
Right. Okay, so how did you hear it, Jerry?
Well, you're always looking to put more events in your building. And Jerry was the one to know if you wanted to have the biggest acts around.
So you remember what the first gig you did with Jerry was?
I remember the 1971 gig with Elvis Presley.
So what was that like?
Bedlam. Absolute bedlam. They had three different floors in the Bellevue Stratford Hotel. And they kind of sort of had to prop Elvis up to get him up on the stage. So, and then he put on a fabulous show.
Okay, so they posted him up there. Now, you have a long history running buildings, et cetera. How'd you get in the business?
Well, I was a pencil pusher. So I started at the Spectrum as a bookkeeper. And in a few months, I became the business manager. And I went because in an arena, there's usually only one or two in each major city. And I was in the private arena. So if I had to go somewhere else, I had to go to another city. So I traveled around the country quite a bit.
So you were in Philly. You were obviously had a long tenure here in L.A. at the Forum. And
yes.
What were some of the cities
in
between?
Well, in between, I went down to Orlando, Florida. And Bill Putnam, who owned the hockey team in Philadelphia, hired me to be the financial VP. And we tried to open something called Wild Kingdom. It never went. And we sold a few animals on the courthouse steps. And then I went to Cleveland. And in Cleveland was where I met Sal Bonifetti. And I took him out to the site. And I gave him my spiel. This is where the trucks will go underneath, and this is where the stage entrance will be, and all of it. And Sal pulled himself up to his full height And he said to me, "This is a friggin' mud hole." He said, "You better book the municipal building for the same dates because it'll never get done." But it did get done. And although we thought we had all the traffic problems taken care of, the opening night of Frank Sinatra, and we had medallions with an image of Frank for all the women, the traffic was so bad that in their long gowns and their husbands in tuxes, they pulled their cars over to the side of the state interstate and they walked the rest of the way.
Okay, that's great. And then from Cleveland to LA?
From Cleveland, I went to LA.
Okay, Bob. I got you over here. It's like, okay, you were telling me a story in the green room, how you were fraternity brothers with Mike Ovitz. Tell us how we get from there to working with Jerry.
We were roommates in college.
Okay.
At UCSB, and traveled down to Universal Studios that was hiring young people to work at the studio. So I started there picking up papers and then became a tour guide, and eventually I was booking the amphitheater.
Okay, and how did you meet Jerry?
Well, the first season of the amphitheater, we wanted as major acts as we could get, and one of those was John Denver. Jerry was managing John, and we had to convince people to not play the Greek.
And what was your pitch?
Well, the primary pitch was the throw of the theater was so much less than the Greek. If you were sitting in the cheap seats in right. the Greek, you were way back there. If you were sitting in the cheap seats at the amphitheater, which were $6.50 for the prime seats.
$6.55, $50, and $4.50.
You'd be equal to where you were in the prime seats at the Greek. And we had about 100 more seats, so we could gross up a little bit more.
I got to tell you, moving to L.A., the Universal Amphitheater, worst thing they ever did was put the roof on it, which I know they had to do. It was such an experience. The Greek, to this day, is not close to what the Universal Amphitheater was.
Well, yeah. I mean, the roof was because the noise was right. going out in the community, and they were getting a lot of grief. Actually, the first act that played the amphitheater was the Grateful Dead. the heads of Universal said they wanted to make this a counterculture complex. So the
who said that? Do you remember who that was?
Well, that was Wasserman.
Really?
Yeah. but that it was John Denver and it was the Carpenters and acts like that. But the opening act was the Grateful Dead, and they had a curfew at 11 o'clock. And I don't know if you've ever been to a Dead concert, but they don't get off at 11 o'clock.
So that did they stay on?
They stayed on, and that was one of the reasons why they had to put the roof on, because they couldn't keep the curfew, and the community just went up in arms.
Okay, your roommates with Ovitz, do you have any idea he's going to have the arc that he does?
No, I mean, Mike wanted to be a doctor. Yeah, he really didn't have an interest in that business at the time.
And are you still in contact with him?
Somewhat. Our family was very, very close.
Okay, so once again, you're working at the Universal Amphitheater. How do you meet Jerry?
So I meet Jerry in booking John Denver. Jerry was incredible, and he said, "Leave here and come to work for me." And I said, "Well, I have this commitment to Universal because they had put me through law school." And he said, "Well, when's that up?" And I said, "Well, that's up in 3 years." He said, "Okay, well," he kept pressing, and then he said, "Well, I'm moving out to California. And I've just started with this fellow, Mickey Rudin." Because I told Jerry, I said, "Look, I'd like to do that, but I'd like to have some experience practicing law. I want to practice law." He said, "Okay, go meet this guy, Mickey Rudin, who he just started."
For those who don't know, he was the fixer who had a reputation for, let's say, being on the wrong side.
So Jerry had just started working with Mickey. I went and interviewed with Mickey. Mickey, you interviewed, he smoked a cigar like Jerry did, Cuban cigars every day. And when the cigar was through, the interview was through. So I started working with Mickey and representing Jerry. And then Jerry said, Okay, now leave Mickey.
Okay, just to make this clear, you met him when you were just starting law school and he waited 3 years?
No, I had finished law school and had a 3-year commitment to university.
I see. But you played that out?
Played that out.
And really, because usually an opportunity, if you don't take it now, never returns.
Well, they had paid for school.
I'm talking about Jerry. Jerry
was great.
Okay.
Yeah, Jerry was great.
Now, Peter, you're an Englishman. How did you run into Jerry?
I met Jerry in September of 1971 at the Troubadour when he had John Denver was playing there. I represented an English band called the Moody Blues.
Never heard of them.
And we'd been touring, you know, for a number of years in America.
Let's go back, because I happen to be a huge Moody Blues fan. Yeah. When did you get started with the Moody Blues?
Wow. I'm trying to cut the story down. I became friends. I met them at some clubs in London when they were playing.
Denny Lane is in the group, or he's already gone?
No, Denny had just left.
Okay.
And they were starting their new band with John,
right?
John Lodge and Justin Hayward. And they had a gig this one night, a club. It was an after-show party for a film that was been playing, and they said, "Can you help us? Our road manager can't do it." I said, "Yeah, of course. What do you want?" So they said, "He'll give you his van and equipment. Can you bring it down to the gig and do it, and then take it?" So I said, "Okay, no problem." So I took the equipment down. We unloaded it, played this club till 4 o'clock in the morning, and they said, "Look, you know, we've only got like £15, so you know you can have it." I said, no, I don't need it. That's fine. It's just fun, you know." So then Justin said to me, "Could you bring the equipment and the van to a recording studio tomorrow afternoon?" I said, "Yeah, just tell me where to be and I'll be there." So it was at Decca Studios in West Hampstead, and I turned up there and met their production manager, road manager. We unloaded the equipment, and I thought, "That's it, I'm done." And then Justin turned around and said to me, "Would you like to stay and watch the session?" So I said, "Yeah, I've never been in a studio before." And so he said, "Yeah." He said, "We're putting Knights down." Knights in White Sand.
Right.
So I was like, "Wow." So, I mean, I had been friends with him for a few months. It wasn't just like a week or something. So they used the equipment. When they finished with the equipment, the road manager packed it up and he left. And I stayed. And I made tea and, you know, and sandwiches. And we went on till 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And then they'd finished it. They said, "Okay, we've got to get the recording executives in now from Decca and this American guy." And they all came in and we're sitting there. And they said, "Okay, play it." And we're all sitting in the studio and it was like, boom. And we were stunned, everybody, the band, everybody was stunned, because it was actually a demonstration disc for DRAM for stereo. That's what it was made for. And so we're sitting there and it was like, wow. And then somebody in the band turned around and said, "Peter, can you go down the studio?" I said, yeah, sure, you know, I'm in the way, I better go. So I said, "Oh, I'll go." You know, they said, no, just go down the studio. I went down the studio. A couple of minutes later, they said, "Peter, come up." I went up to the room and I said, "Do you want a job?" I said, "What?" I said, "Yeah, do you want to be our road manager?"
And there you have it. Now, you told me you just retired from road management within the last 12 months.
I keep trying. Yes.
Okay, so let's go back to the narrative.
Sorry.
You're at the Troubadour. Yeah. And how do you meet and go to work for Jerry?
I didn't go to work for him then. I was representing the Moody's, and we'd done quite a few tours in America. And and, you know, all in Europe. And we'd, in those days of the 60s, you were screwed over more times than you knew. You didn't get paid. They gave you half the money. They gave you part, you know, whatever. And the deals, this is where Jerry came. This is what Jerry was all about. When you do a deal with somebody, like we did this one, the last tour I did before Jerry, I was, because I wasn't a tour manager. I was a road manager. I didn't really know the whole science of what went on. And so we hired a guy, an American guy, to teach me on the road what went on. And so we were coming near the end of this tour and we were going and playing four or five arenas. And I'm talking about somewhere in 70, 71, somewhere in there, in that, you know, way back then. And this tour manager guy who was teaching me turned around and said, "Now, I know you always want cash because you always get screwed now, and I know that these last three or four shows are huge." I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, that's too much cash. You can't play with that." And I said, "Well, how are we going to get paid? We're playing 10, 11,000 seat arenas. That's a lot of money even in those days." So he said, "Look, this guy is good for it." Okay, Barry Fay.
God.
But he, no, God bless him. He was. So the last night, he comes and I'm expecting the money, the band, we're all expecting the money. And he says, "No, come to my house." And we thought, here we go again. But true to his word, he had a briefcase, he opened it, and there was all the money. And the deal sheet. When I looked at the deal sheet, he made as much money as we did. Because that was the deals they did in those days.
Okay. And
so
we'll get back to that.
Am I going back?
We'll get back. Peter, John, yes. Now, you still operate under the name Concerts West, which, of course, Jerry started, and you're promoting the Stones as we sit here. But you had a tenure in the early days. Tell us how you got to work with Jerry.
Well, I started in one of the Concerts West offices. So when I started, which was 1978, a lot of college concert promoters back then. And I was at Washington State University, and I was lucky because it was a Pac-8 at the time building. We had like a 12,000 seat arena but Spokane, which was a major market north of us, only had like a 10,000 or not even that, 7,000 seat Civic Auditorium. So we got the bigger shows because we had the bigger capacity. So that's how I got to know the Concerts West guys. And I actually got hired by a guy named Tom Hewlett, who everybody up here knows. And Tom was up in the Seattle office and brought me on you know, you started hearing about this guy, Jerry Weintraub, down in Los Angeles, because we were all up in Seattle, and he was, you know, it was this larger-than-life guy, it really was. I got there the year after Elvis had died, and it was a pretty, you know, turning point, I think, somewhat in the company, because that was such a big part of that company at the beginning. But I was fortunate enough to be there when all the big tours were going on. So it was Bad Companies and Bee Gees and Eric Clapton, Dan Fogelberg, Boz Scaggs, the Beach Boys, Chicago, Queen. I mean, it was like one company's doing all these tours. But what was kind of interesting is that his model, you know, he started that model. Really?
Well, explain to the audience what the model is.
The model is touring, national touring, or now what we do is international touring in that. And see, the promoters were either raised in a local marketplace, you know, you had Avalon Attractions or Wolf Rissmiller in Los Angeles, and you had Bill Graham in San Francisco and Ron Delsner in New York. But what Jerry did, which was so unique, was... he looked at his artists and said, you know, why can't we go out and be the promoter? We know, you know, how to sell our artists better than anybody else does. We use the arenas, if anything, as our local partners, because we figured they knew about the marketplace. They had great advertising deals. So it was always the arenas place their advertising. But what was so unique about it is we did everything ourselves. We never worked with local promoters. And we would go in and rent the building and find limo companies and hire caterers, and we would get our tickets from QuickTick, and you'd send them to a box office, and they'd get sent out to record stores to sell, and you'd come in at, you know, and you'd do it city after city after city. And it was just the manager and the concert company.
So there was no agent?
Well, I don't know. Bob, what can I say about that?
You ought to get into that. I mean, it created a whole war in the entertainment business.
Yeah, I mean, Bob could talk more about that because we just looked at it and said, wait a minute, what are we paying these people for? And I mean, that was Led Zeppelin, the Bee Gees, Eric Clapton, the Moody Blues, every big act in the world at that time. And when I started, we had more tours than we had people to go out and cover them. Remember, we could hire Charlie Brusco in Atlanta. You didn't have to pay him, just gave him a backstage pass, and he'd go settle the show for you.
Well, you weren't making that much money, if I remember.
No, God, I was making $200 a week. I remember when I moved to Los Angeles in 1981, I think, when we moved everybody down to 9744 Wilshire, the famous Management 3 Concerts West. And I remember finding out that Bob Finkelstein made $100,000 a year. And I went, oh, my God. He was like he was the guru. Bob was the president of Management 3. And was like, oh my God. And they would drive up in these, you know, and Jerry got to park his Rolls on the ramp at the Forum. I mean, it was like, whoa. I was like, you know, and I was just, I mean, I started when I was down here, like a lot of my first job was I ran messages from 9744 Wilshire over to Jerry and Jimmy Niederlander at the Polo Lounge. That's what I did. Here, go take them over messages, you know. And then you get a little lecture from one of them, or, you know, they tell you a story. You get a Jimmy Niederlander story, you get a Jerry story, you go back and forth. And I did that for months. So, yeah, I started on the ground.
He'd be excited about your success, and he'd be thrilled about it. And I know he was.
He was, I know.
Okay, Michael, this is your father. Most of us did not grow up with a famous, rich, and powerful father. When did you realize he was Jerry Weintraub?
Well, first of all, he was always Jerry Weintraub. I've talked to, you know, he and my mother, who was his first wife, went to high school together. And they were high school sweethearts. They got married when they were 20 years old. And he was always Jerry Weintraub. He was always bigger than life from the beginning. And anybody who knew him back then will tell you that they knew that he was going to be the success that he was. Jane, who he married in 1965, who's my stepmother since I was 3 years old, and who, thank God, is still doing great in Kennebunkport, Maine right now. I talked to her just a little while ago while we were up at the exhibit. But, you know, Jane is the one who really saw what he could be. She's the one who said to him, you're going to walk with kings and presidents. And he believed it. And she believed it. And they set out together to make that happen. And over the next, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, that's what they did. But for me as a kid, you don't know. As a kid, it's your only reality. And I lived half the time with my mother in a 2-bedroom, 1-bath apartment in Riverdale, and the other half with Dad and Jane in a penthouse apartment overlooking the Museum of Modern Art. And then in 1975, we moved out here to California to a huge house in Beverly Hills. And I went from being a kid who could get around New York City on my own at 12 years old by subway and cab and express bus to a kid who was behind a gate and couldn't get anywhere. It was a very big life change for me. But by then, it was pretty apparent, you know, his success, and that it was different than what most kids were living.
Okay,
and the fact that I was going on the road with him and the Colonel.
At what age?
The first Elvis tour was 71, so I was 9 years old when I first went on the road.
Okay, so you're on the road with your father. Neither your mother nor stepmother are there.
Jane was performing still.
Okay.
Jane was a big singer.
No, but I mean, when you're on the road with Elvis.
Okay. I was with Dad.
Okay.
I was with Dad.
And he's working pretty hard, so you're like unsupervised.
I was tagging along. He took me everywhere. He took me to breakfast with the Colonel.
He became unsupervised later.
Yeah. John had the unfortunate task of supervising me a few times later on. But yeah, so I really spent time with him, and we went all over the country. I went all over the country with him and Elvis, with him and John Denver, with him and Frank. And it was an amazing way to grow up.
Now my father, who needless to say was a real estate appraiser, known the liquor store, he was working all the time, but whenever I was one-on-one with him, he was always imparting life lessons. So when you were on the road with your father, was he like giving you instruction?
No, absolutely not. He couldn't teach what he did. You could observe it, you could try to understand it, but he couldn't teach it. And so I don't ever remember him sitting down with me and saying, here's how you do it. But I do remember always being able to be with him and watch him do it.
And
I learned from that.
Okay, so did you know the Colonel and Elvis?
I knew the Colonel. I met Elvis twice. I wouldn't say I knew him.
So do you think the Colonel was born in America or not?
I think the Colonel was probably not born in America, but who cares?
Right. Now, if you don't know, that's famously...
He was the Colonel.
He was famously why he didn't have Elvis tour overseas. Do you want to say something, Claire?
Yes. I have a funny story about Tom Hewlett.
Why don't you first explain who Tom was?
Okay. Tom was the head of Concerts West. And when I knew Tom, he was already involved with Jerry. And we had put on this concert, and Tom was there. And he said, I'm hungry. I want to go out and eat afterwards. I said, okay. And he had his usual cowboy look on, no jacket. It was warm weather. And I figured, where am I going to take him in Philadelphia? It's late. Maybe a hotel would be the best idea. So the best hotel in Philadelphia at that time was the Bellevue Stratford. And we walk in, and the maitre d' says, of course we can seat you, but the gentleman will have to wear a jacket. And Tom says, a jacket? What do you mean? Well, it's a rule here in the hotel. Gentlemen have to wear jackets, and I will lend you a jacket. And Tom looked at him, scowled, and said, I can go anywhere in the country. I can go anywhere in California without a jacket, and I'll be damned if I'm going to come in here and wear that scraggly old jacket you want me to wear.
So what happened?
Naturally, we didn't get served.
So, Bob, let's go back. Once you leave practicing law and you're working for Jerry, what is your gig?
President of Manager 3 in Concerts West. So
you oversaw both?
Both.
And that continued for how long?
That was about 5 years.
Okay. So Concerts West was just developing, and we've heard stories about the innovation of Jerry. Do you remember other innovations that you had working with Concerts West and Jerry?
Well, I mean, the genius of Concerts West was a fair count. I mean, one of the lines from Mickey Rudin, he did tell those things that, like you asked. He said, if anybody ever asks you what you want in life, first count. So now you've got people going out on the road that were not getting first count.
Okay, that was when, as Peter said, that was when it was a cash business.
Well, it was a cash business, but even if it wasn't a cash business, that's the cash that they already counted.
So, and it was before computers.
Well, but it was when you had all of the with the agents, and they were driving prices and looking for guarantees, and then some of the promoters were put up against it, and they would find ways to make the guarantee work. And the ways they would make the guarantee work, the facility charge might not be accurate. The sound and lights might not be accurate. The catering was a little bit too high. Concerts West didn't do any of that.
To this day.
You could always promise more to your artists.
The artists would always get more, but not only would they get more, they'd get it right. So, I mean, one of Jerry's best ideas was once a concert was sold out, he took a thank you ad out. Or he'd take a second ad out when you didn't need the second ad because it was going to bring it back the next time and was going to make the concert more exciting. He would never let any seats go in the first five rows that weren't to the fans.
And he learned that from Elvis and the Colonel.
Right.
And if you ever let your artist play with empty seats, you were dead.
But I still do that today.
Oh, yeah.
Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
First 10 rows. Must go and sell to the public.
Well, in his book, he talks about the first thing he does Elvis. So when you're in this situation, especially in the 70s, how do you fill the seats?
Wow, we had some great techniques back then. You know what the best one was?
The hospitals and the
hospitals.
Yeah.
No, but it's the nurses. See, there's if you got 200 beds, you know, you may have 80 or whatever, two nurses per bed, whatever, a nurse per every two, whatever. But there's two shifts always not working when the concert's going on. So our line was always, Mr. Denver was, we're holding these seats for the record companies. We can't put them back on seats. So Mr. Denver likes us to offer them up to, you know, people who could use them and da 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 da. And that's how we got to know a lot of nurses. But it was great. I mean, nurses, the hospitals, they were like number one. Then you go firemen and police after that. But hospitals were the best, yeah. Right?
I did that in the Vietnam War was going on. And we had a show down in San Diego. And it just wasn't going. And so my brother-in-law was a colonel in the Marine Corps at Camp Pendleton. So I turned around and said, Monty, I got some seats. We want to da 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 here. And, you know, could you use them? He said, what? Oh, we got all these guys, you know, that are cooped up in the camp. They love it. They sent busloads of troops, of Marines to the facility. And many years later, when his daughter got married, there was this 4-star general there. And turned around, he said, Peter, I want you to come and meet this guy. And he went up and said, Colonel, and he had this name. And he said, this is the man that provided something like 2,000 seats to the Marine Corps when they were all in Vietnam. And he went, oh, thank you. And he turns around and he pulls this coin out of his pocket. And apparently it's some calling card. And he gives it to me and he says, you ever need anything?
Wow.
You just give them that. I mean,
have you ever used it?
No. I don't get in trouble. Try not to.
I remember a story. I'll never forget in Houston, Texas at the Summit after the show. I get reamed over the phone. I don't know what I'm getting reamed for by your dad. And all I know is I need to go see the principal. Neil was always called the principal. You know, getting to see the principal. And Bonafetti would always be on the phone or on the radio going, oh, the principal's protrusion is protruding from the principal, you know. So you have to go in and see the principal. And I go walking in to Neil's dressing room. And he goes, you know, John, I walked out there tonight. And the flag rolled right. Remember, flag on America always rolled down. And I looked out and it was just nothing but a mass of people. And I went to the right. And there was a mass of people, and I went to the left, and I walked behind the stage, and there were five empty rows, and I didn't know what to do. And all you could do is go, you know, I'm sorry, Mr. Diamond, it'll never happen again, right? That was it. And then you got Man, you did that. You got reamed if there were empty seats. With John Denver, it was also, remember, the light from the curtains? That was like his thing with the light from the curtains from the VOMs, you know, how they'd have curtains to close it over so the concourse light wouldn't go in. He'd go nuclear if those things were left open, you know? But all of them had their little things, you know, you had to learn it.
Okay, Bob, going back to management, you work with a lot of characters. Now, did you work with Peter Grant, your personally?
Peter Grant, a little bit. The Led Zeppelin tours, it just about tailed out.
Okay. I was wondering what it was like between him and Jerry, because certainly...
They had a great relationship.
Really?
Yeah, they had a very, very good relationship. Jerry had a long-standing relationship with their attorney.
Okay.
What's his name?
Forget his name at the moment. Yeah. But
Stephen's Weiss.
Okay.
Stephen's Weiss.
Yes.
Yeah, Stephen Weiss.
So talking about the management company. So when you came in, he already had John Denver.
Denver, Diamond, Dylan, Moody Blues, Carpenters, Beach Boys. I mean, we represented Rick James. We represented the Pointer Sisters. We did the Commodores tour.
Okay, usually acts are, you know, they want complete attention. Other than John Denver, who ultimately left for his own reasons, the acts didn't leave. What made them stay at Management 3?
Well, Jerry was that type of person. When you were in the room with him, you were the only person in the room. So he had that ability to just have that laser focus and no problem. And there were really good people taking care of business. TCB was Elvis Presley's motto.
Right. Claire, you want to
Bob,
you talk about...
You know, there were wonderful things that happened all the time. But lest you should go home and think, there were never things that happened that really needed attention. We recently had a new owner at the Forum, and that was an entrepreneur named Jerry Buss. Jerry Buss came up with an idea that we didn't have any seats that were boxes. So he came up with this idea. We'll take the second level of the arena and take 320 seats in the rows in the second level, which usually had a lesser price. And we will make them like a box. You'll have waitress service, and you'll get the stats if it's a game, and you'll get programs if it's a concert. And he marketed them so that you got every event that was held in the arena, which turned out to be a big mistake because it cost us a lot of money. And everybody learned from our mistake.
Now, they were called Senate seats, right?
They were called Senate seats. And it was left to me to negotiate how much would be paid for every concert. And I must say that one of Mr. Weintraub's representatives ripped me up and down and sideways about these seats. And I shed a few tears, but never for anything he saw. And I worried about it at night. But we went on, and we did many, many successful shows.
Whatever happened with the seats? Did you pay or not pay?
Well, of course we paid, but we paid the regular price that you would have gotten.
Okay, because this is an argument today, seats that are off and around the manifest. Yes. You know, people are still fighting. Michael, you wanted to say something?
No, I was just going to say, you asked about Peter Grant and Dad's relationship with Peter. And, you know, Peter was also bigger than life. But Dad had great relationships with anybody like that. I mean, whether it was Colonel Parker, Peter Grant, Arthur Wirtz. He loved guys that were bigger than Frank Sinatra.
I'd say hypothetically somebody crossed him, then what?
Oh, you never wanted to be his enemy. He was the best friend in the world to have and the worst enemy. You wanted him in a foxhole next to you. You didn't want him shooting at you.
And he was legendarily friends with the Bushes. Were you exposed to that?
Very much so, from the time I was very young. And that's through Jane. You know, Jane grew up in Kennebunkport. She and George Bush, I asked her a couple of years ago, I said, when did you and George Bush first meet? And she said, we didn't meet, we just were. They were the same age. They knew each other as long as either one of them could remember. And did Dad ever tell you the story of the first time he met George Bush?
I think he did, but tell our audience.
It's a great story. Jane takes him up to Kennebunkport in 1964 for the first time and takes him to the Kennebunk River Club to play tennis. And the Kennebunk River Club is what you would expect. I know you're from New England. What you would expect.
I'm amazed they let a Jew play.
Well, they didn't. So he went and signed his name, and they said, Weintraub, are you Jewish? And he said, yes. And they said, well, you can't play tennis here. You're not allowed to play tennis here. And he got very upset. He let loose a string of Bronx words and went back to Jane's farm and said, I'm out of here. I'm gone. I'm back to New York. I don't need lobster and all this other crap. I'm going to go home and have a cheeseburger and a Coca-Cola and go back to my business. And she said, no, just stay one more day. So the next morning at 6 a.m, the phone rings, and he answers it. He's already awake working. And the guy at the other end of the phone says, is this Jerry Weintraub? He says, yes. He said, well, you don't know me, but my name's George Bush. I've known Janie forever, my whole life. And I understand you had a little problem at the River Club yesterday. He said, well, I don't know if I'd call it a little problem. There are a bunch of anti-Semites over there. They told me I couldn't play, told me I wasn't allowed to play tennis. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, Jerry. He said, you don't know me, but meet me over there at 10 o'clock this morning, and you and I and the club president and the club pro are going to play doubles. And Dad said, you don't listen very good, do you? He said, oh, no, I listen just fine, but let me tell you something. My family built that place, and they're going to let you play, or I'm going to burn the fucking place down.
That is a story I hadn't heard.
So
it's almost a showstopper.
As you can imagine, he followed George Bush wherever George Bush went from that day on.
I know, he's very loyal, and George seemed loyal to him. So, Peter, what was your ultimate gig when you start to work for Jerry?
Well, as I said, we were looking with the Moody's. We were looking for a promoter. Well, we were not going to work under those conditions. And so my agent in England turned around and said, I found this guy called Jerry Weintraub. So I said, yeah. So he said, and he's got this company with Concerts West. They'd like to meet you. So I got on a plane from London, went to LA, and I'm trying to think who met me. Dan Fiella. Remember Danny?
Yeah, Danny passed away.
He was another one of
year.
Our guys. Yeah. Who passed away. And Danny said, gave me this letter. And he said, and it was from Jerry. I wish I'd kept it. And he said, sorry, I can't be here. But I'm doing this show tonight at the Troubadour with John Denver, and you're welcome to come. I said, yeah, let's go check in the hotel and I'll go. So I went there, saw him. Following day, met him. And I said, you know, you got a proposal? And he said, yeah, I've got a proposal to put you. We want to offer you $85.15. I said, $85.15? He said, yeah. I said, not. And so we went over it. And I said, you got a deal. So he said, okay, will you sign a contract? I said, no, we don't sign contracts anymore. You got my hand? No, shake your hand and we got a deal. And that's how I met him and started to work. I was still with the Moody Blues all that time. And then when they eventually broke up, and that was in 71. They broke up in 74. I did a couple of odd things. And then in 77... I asked him for a job.
And what was your job?
Basically, it's like John, we were all, what we all did, we were like tour managers. We ran tours. It wasn't always these big tours. Sometimes, I mean, I did Queen. I did 20 shows. Yeah, I did 20 shows. We had 20 dates with Queen.
I remember that. And I did those with you, actually.
Yeah, we used to get stuff like that. And then I did the Long Run tour with the Eagles.
Now, at the time, was there an accountant on the road or did you do the settlement?
We did the settlement. Yeah, see, we did.
There were two guys.
Yeah, there were two guys. One in production and one lead, we used to say.
Yeah. Yeah, that was it. And then when you could, if you like, were good enough, you graduated to be the lead guy.
Yeah.
And we had a thing called show pay. What was show pay? $80?
Yeah.
$80. So if like, if you're out with Peter Gongware, they'd split that with you 40-40. If you were Sims or Jay, you got $20 if you're with Jay.
Yeah, that was, see, me and John and Paul Gongware, we.
Okay,
we
you've
close.
All had long careers. Did anybody leave the operation?
I did eventually, yeah.
Well, I think the only reason we all left is because Jerry went from being in the music business to being in the
movie business.
That's kind of, I mean, because we're all like, I went all the way through Weintraub Entertainment Group, and then it was like, God, you know, he wasn't doing anything in music anyway. I think that Earth, Wind & Fire management deal was probably the last management deal he did, right?
Ken Cragen had left.
Yeah.
Cragen used to work for Jerry?
Cragen worked there.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, some of the names that worked at this place would absolutely blow you away that were there.
I hear from like Ken like every day, and it's like he invented the business. I didn't know he worked for Jerry. I'll give him a little bit of a hard time.
Yeah.
He'll tell you about it
at the
you
height
ask him.
Of Kenny Rogers.
Yeah, that's right.
Kenny Rogers built Blue Heaven.
And then who are any other people in the management side who we would know of?
Sal Bonifetti.
Sal.
A great.
Jim Golden.
Well, Claire was an Italian guy that, and Jerry and he were very good friends. But Jerry, one of Jerry's, everything had to be Jerry Weintraub Presents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Jerry Weintraub Presents was as prominent as anything else in any ad. Billy Friedkin's nickname for Jerry is Presents. when Jerry did Diner and Barry Levinson was just screwing around with him, if you look at the credits on Diner, the credits of Jerry Weintraub Picture are about 10 times bigger than the Diner and Barry Levinson. And Frank had a wicked sense of humor. And one time he's playing Caesar's Palace and Sal Bonifetti is out on the road with Frank. And Frank says to the Caesar's Palace guys, we're gonna put up on the marquee here, Sal Bonifetti Presents.
Oh, God.
That would have led to Sal's premature death.
He worked Sid Bernstein.
Sid Bernstein. Norman Weiss.
Sid Bernstein was the first man. He brought the Beatles.
He and Norman brought the Beatles.
Management 3 was
Hummer. Oh, yeah, this was before, yeah.
And Bernie Brillstein.
How did Bernie Brillstein start
his own thing?
When Jerry kept the name Management 3, but when these three guys broke up, that's when Bernie started. I think Bernie started with the guys from Saturday Night Live.
Bernie came out to California to open the LA office.
What was Bernie doing before?
He and Marty and Dad were together in New York.
Right.
At 136 East 55th Street in an apartment that they had converted illegally into an office. that I grew up in, sort of. And Bernie got sent out to California to open the California office. Bernie had the Muppets. Bernie had Jim Henson. Dad had John Denver. This was
That's how they got together.
They were together at the time that they both signed.
Put
each
that
signed
really together.
But then
John
later
Denver
on,
the
yes,
Muppets.
That's how John Denver
it,
and the Muppets got
that.
Together. Dad and Bernie ultimately decided to go separate ways. Bernie took Jim Henson and the Muppets. Saturday Night Live started out as a vehicle for the Muppets. So if you actually go back and watch
the
original show,
the Muppets were on there.
A vehicle for the Muppets.
Wow. That's an amazing story. So, Bob, since you work with Jerry every day, any other lessons or any other funny stories you can tell us about Jerry?
There aren't. I mean, Jerry was just larger than life. I mean, it's there. It's you know, when he wasn't going to come into the office and an act was waiting there for him, that was a you know, where's Jerry? But no, Jerry was larger than life, and I don't. There wasn't. He had a wicked sense of humor, but he ran a business.
I see. And how did your tenure end?
I had just reached a point where I wanted to do some other things. And
what did Jerry say when you left the family?
It was not a good party. It was not a good party.
Did you ever make up?
It took us years. And in fact, we played golf the day before he passed away. And I have a place in Santa Barbara, and Jerry was up in Santa Barbara, and we had played golf that Saturday. I think it was on the 4th of July weekend. And then I'm driving, and I hear on the radio that that Jerry Weintraub had passed away in Palm Springs. I said, "Well, that's impossible. I was just with him." He's here in Montecito, and I called and I got Susie on the phone, and she was at the hospital. So it was so sudden. It was so unexpected.
Wow, Claire, you going to add something here?
I was just going to tell a funny story about John Denver. We did a gig that was going to be two shows in the same evening, one at 7:30 and one at 10:30, something like that.
Was the Forum a union building?
Yes, Stagehands.
So it was a lot of cost to have two shows.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Yes. And I had just hired a new assistant, and he worked that day. And by the time the first show was over, the poor kid was exhausted. And so I said, "Look, you have to work up to this. You have to be on your feet 12, 13 hours before you can do a double show." Because in those days, circus ran three performances on a Saturday. So I let him go home, and I worked the second show, and it was the best show that John ever did. And he was always sorry that I was so much older, and he was tired, and I still worked the second show.
Unbelievable. John, your long tenure with Jerry, any lessons you learned from him?
A couple things. One was he used to always say, "Never assume anything." I remember that. Never assume anything. That was one of his lines. And then Bob said it, TCB. We all grew up with TCB, which was take care of business. It was started on the Elvis tour jackets. But if you go back all the old Concerts West tour jackets, you'll always see a little patch on there that said TCB. And it just meant take care of business. And it was, you know, it was a work ethic of a sort. We, you know, you're doing a tour. You're not like working the local scams like Bob is talking about. You're out there. You're partners with the artist. You're being transparent. You know, there's no, and it's even better today because the internet doesn't even allow you to be to steal anymore. You can find anything.
Stealing less.
We never even. I'm glad we don't have to like people go look at our past because it's clean. But it's just been. It's a way of doing it. It's a different way. And it was Jerry, and it was Tom, and it was Terry Bassett and Bill McKenzie, were the guys who started that. When you go out in the exhibit, you'll see the P&L there for one of the shows, okay? Bill McKenzie made that P&L up, you know, paid by cash, paid by box office, paid by home office, paid by infield check, right? And all the list. When I had, after, you know, started meeting other local promoters, because we really didn't know them that well, I started looking at the form, and I go, "Well, that form looks familiar. Where'd you get it?" Yes. Every promoter in the country was using Bill McKenzie's form to settle shows. Ron Delzer, they just took the Concert Sweat heading off and put it there. But, it, you know, the first time we did wire transfers, that's How, you know, it was Bill McKenzie who came up with that whole thing about we would sign a piece of paper and the building would wire the money the next morning. That was, this, it had never been done before, you know, with no computerized ticketing. It was all.
Now, if you're green at $200 a week and there are only two of you out there, is you the senior guy training you or you'd have to make decisions by yourself?
A little both. I mean, the senior guy should be training you.
Yeah. But did you feel pressure? I remember I worked for these English guys. They said, we're paying you. You have to handle it. Or would you ever freak out and say, I got to call somebody?
Well, there was, it depends. No. You could always, you were a partnership. If the partnership didn't work, then we'd break up the partnership and find somebody else. And there were times where we'd go, you know, so-and-so is not working right on the Bee Gees, send them over to Bad Company and we'll take them on the Bee Gees and they go do Bad Company. And so we got moved around. We were just, we were told where to go. Yeah. I would somebody walk in my office and go to L.A., go see Jay Hagerman, you go down the road with Eric Clapton. I'm like, okay, you know, and that's how it would be.
Okay, if you're out that much, do you start to dislike the music?
No. That's why we do it. That's what we love. Yeah.
Okay. Now, Bob, there was a famous meeting on Long Island to try to break up Jerry's ruling roost. Can you tell us about that?
All of the promoters thought that they would divide up the country like the mafia.
Right.
So Belkin would have Cleveland and Delsner would have New York. And Graham would have San Francisco, and Wolf Reesmiller would have L.A., and Jerry would be frozen out of the business because these were their territories, and they had exclusive, or thought they had exclusives with the buildings. And that was a battle that had to be fought, but the acts are the power. When you're representing the Rolling Stones, you're going to make the deal. And they're going to and the building is going to have you. So,
you didn't encounter any static doing this?
Tremendous static, and some of it was, you know, there. Jerry always believed in leaving something on the table for the other guy. So, as you go into these facilities, you might pay a local promoter, but you had the act, and you're doing a national promotion, so you're getting the best deal. You give the other guy something. And it worked itself out.
Well, and that's why several of the promoters who were at that meeting in Long Island walked out of the room and immediately got on the phone to California and called Dad and said, hey, here's what just happened. And Dad said, well, you go back in there and you tell Graham and Barcelona and those guys to circle the whole country and put Concerts West.
We did get the law changed in California. There was a tremendous tension between agents and managers in the music business, because the law in California said that you had to have a licensed talent agent in order to book you. And the famous case is a Jefferson Airplane case where this manager had booked somebody to get them a gig when an agent wouldn't even give them the time of day. And years later, they went to the Labor Commission and rescinded the contract. And they had to disgorge everything that they had earned. And so we, at a point in time, I said, Jerry, this isn't working. And we went up to the state of California. We had a relationship with Governor Brown and Willie Brown. And we got the law changed to have an exemption for the recorded business. And if you worked with a licensed talent agent, you were exempt.
Let's go back, because we covered this earlier, that you did a national tour. You really didn't need the agent. So how did you handle that?
They didn't have agents.
We didn't have any.
Yeah, John Denver. Elvis had the William Morris Agency, which was a longtime relationship with Colonel Parker.
And did you pay them, or Colonel paid them out of his end?
Probably paid him out of his end, because I don't remember us paying him. But John Denver didn't have an agent. Frank didn't have an agent. And what do they need an agent for to book a gig that they're going to be selling out when they can get an 85-15 deal
I totally agree, and we see that today. So
I'd love an 85-15 deal today.
That doesn't exist.
Yeah, right. So, Peter, what did you learn from Jerry?
The act always came first. You always took care of the act to just keep them happy, comfortable, and the act came first.
So,
what was that? I heard something back there.
So, if the act wanted something unreasonable, you said
no,
yes?
No. We would just take care of business.
If basically, the act wanted something unreasonable, he'd walk around backstage and go, who the hell does that guy think he is? Yeah. Jerry Weintraub?
No, we didn't. We didn't do that.
Well, you were on the road all these years.
Yeah.
To what degree were these musicians bad actors?
Bad actors?
Well, what you know, we hear all the stories of drugs, women destroying hotel rooms.
You had some of that. There was always some of that, you know. I was lucky. I've been very lucky. I didn't want to ever want to work with those people. So I didn't.
I've only heard about it.
Oh, okay. Jerry let Rick James stay at his house in Beverly Hills.
God.
In order to get clean.
Did he get clean?
No.
No.
I did have dinner at the Edgewater 3 nights ago.
Okay. Whoa.
I'm serious.
Okay. So
Ronnie went down to check it out.
Tell the famous Mud Shark story.
You can't tell the Mud Shark story.
But
here.
It is, you know, for those of us who haven't been to the Edgewater Inn.
The Edgewater, Led Zeppelin, 1976.
Is there such a thing as a Mud Shark? You seen it?
Yeah. I've caught fish from my window at the Edgewater.
What does a Mud Shark look like?
It's like,
it's pretty big.
Oh, yeah. I was there one night, a couple of times I've done it. It was with Ray Thomas of the Moody Blues. And we were both fishermen. And we would go down, rent the poles and all the stuff, and just sit there all night long, pulling out these
mud
shots.
And you did it from the hotel room?
Yeah.
Tell them what it is.
And then put them in the bath, and then you'd leave them for the money to find.
People would fill up the, you know, not the Led Zeppelin story, but everybody fits out of the window, you fill up the bathtub. And then you catch mud sharks and you throw them in the bathtub. And then sometimes you'd like leave them for the maid.
They've got all the pictures in the hotel.
Now, didn't Bad Company and some of these other acts come with agents? Would it be Frank, Barcelona, or other people?
They had agents earlier on in their career. And when they got big, they left Frank.
Okay.
They left Frank.
Yeah, that was the same with the Moody Blues.
That was the big fight. When Led Zeppelin got rid of Premier and Frank... And concert just did all their tours were. They started opening up for the Vanilla Fudge. That's where their first tour was.
Wow. Okay, so Claire, I have literally sat in the box office with representatives from promoters, and they've shown me the two sets of books. Now, as the business developed, we're talking about 85-15, then 90-10, how did the promoter make money?
You mean the local guy?
He had to get a cut off of somebody else, the local guy, because he was superseded.
Okay. So are there any other stories or characteristics of Jerry we haven't covered?
Well, there's a great story with when Elvis is on tour and he dies. We've got all of this money in the box office. And Elvis is not going to... Elvis has left the building.
Literally.
So... I said, you know, what are we going to do? So we decided, okay, of course everybody can have their money back, but make sure that you get the ticket. In fact, there's some of the tickets that are in the exhibit up here, $15 a piece. People didn't get their tickets back.
Because they wanted the final ticket.
So there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars money in the box office. Problem was many of the buildings that we were playing were municipal buildings, and the state took a position that money escheated to the state.
Ooh, that's a bummer.
So but we said, no, the ticket has value. So it's our money. And then we worked out a deal between splitting it.
Oh, so you got the money.
Yeah, splitting it with Jerry, Elvis, and...
Hey, you know, what's an interesting point on that? You know how people refunded their tickets on that? Is they wrote their name and their address on the back of the ticket and mailed it back to the box office, and then they got a check. Years later, you could go contact all those people, right? And say, you want to get your Elvis ticket back.
And how much did you sell them back for?
They were $15 tickets, but I'm just saying that that's people mailed in their ticket with their name and their address written on the back of the ticket, and then they got a check back.
Speaking of tickets, one thing we know is concert tickets today are expensive, never mind the fees, et cetera. But I remember when they went from $3, $4, and $5 to $350, $450, and $550. How did you decide? And you couldn't get a ticket. That was the day everything sold out, and it was no. So how did you decide on the prices?
Many acts wanted to keep their prices as low as possible. Frank wanted to keep prices as low as possible. I want to talk about the Grateful Dead, $6.50 for a ticket. The escalation just became part of the business and the expense of a tour. Acts generally want their fans to be able to see a concert. They don't want to see the gouge.
How about the famous policy of acts scalping their own tickets? Did we see that at Concerts West?
We had tremendous control on tickets so that that would not take place. I mean, scalping we looked at as really one of the seven deadly sins. So we tried very hard to make sure the tickets were very controlled. Acts at that time did not scalp their own tickets.
Okay, Claire, it seems you want to say something.
We talked about refunding money for tickets. Well, when I was at the Spectrum, we lost the roof during an ice capades time. And that was one thing that Jerry didn't produce.
True.
So it was during a matinee performance and the orchestra started to play Off We Go in the Wild Blue Yonder. Now, we had the ice capades booked for another whole week. So we had a lot of money in the box office. And that was when we decided you would take the ticket back to where you purchased it. So if it was Macy's that sold it or Bloomingdale's, you took it back there. If you bought it from the box office, you took it back there. And it, as you stated, we never refunded all the money, but we became known as the place to go to find out how do you refund a really large amount of money, which was something we really didn't want the reputation for.
Okay, I think that we've really done a great job of illuminating how powerful and larger than life Jerry was. I thank everybody here on the piano told all these great stories. Thanks for coming.